Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Lech Lecha, Genesis chapter 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Go for yourself from your land, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. You shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you." So Abram went as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife, Sarai, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their wealth that they had amassed, and the souls they had amassed in Haran. They left to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed into land as far as the site of Shechem, and to the plain of Moreh. The Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who appeared to him. From there he relocated to the mountain east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. He built there an altar to the Lord and invoked the Lord by name. Then Abram journeyed on, journeying steadily toward the south. Now there was a famine in this land, and Abram descended to Egypt to sojourn there. For the famine was very severe. And it occurred, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, "See now, I have known that you are a beautiful woman of appearance. And it shall occur, when the Egyptians will see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but you they will let live. Please say that you are my sister, so that it may go well with me for your sake, and that I may live on account of you." But it occurred with Abraham's coming to Egypt. The Egyptians saw the woman was very beautiful. When the officials of Pharaoh saw her, they lauded her before Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. And he treated Abram well for her sake. He acquired sheep and cattle, donkeys, slaves, maidservants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh, along with his whole household, with severe plagues, because of the matter of Sarai, the wife of Abram. Pharaoh summoned Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, that I would take her as my wife? Now here is your wife. Take her and go." So Pharaoh gave men's orders concerning him, and they escorted him and his wife and all that was his. Chapter 13. So Abram went up from Egypt, he with his wife and all that was his, and Lot with him, to the south. Now Abram was very laden with livestock, silver and gold. He proceeded on his journeys from the south to Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at first, between Bethel and Ai, to the site of the altar which he had erected there at first. And there Abram invoked the Lord by name. Also Lot, who went with him, Abram had flocks, cattle, and tents. And the land could not support them, dwelling together, for their possessions were abundant, and they were unable to dwell together. And there was quarreling between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. And the Canaanite and the Perizzite were then dwelling in the land. So Abram said to Lot, "Please let there be no strife between me and you, and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not all the land before you? Please separate from me. If you go left, I will go right. If you go right, I will go left." So Lot raised his eyes and saw the entire plain of the Jordan that was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt going toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed from the east. Thus they parted, one from his brother. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, while Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tents as far as Sodom. And the people of Sodom were wicked and sinful toward the Lord exceedingly. The Lord said to Abram after Lot had parted from him, "Raise now your eyes and look out from where you are, northward, south, east, and west. For all the land that you see, to you I will give it, and to your descendants forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. Arise, walk about the land, through its length and its breadth, for I will give it to you." Abram moved his tent and came and dwelled in the plains of Mamre, which are in Hebron, and he built there an altar to the Lord. Chapter 14. And it happened in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, that these made war on Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shimbar, king of Zoboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. And all these had joined in the valley of Siddim, now the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, and they rebelled 13 years. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer, the kings who were with him, came and struck the Rephaim at Ashtaroth-Karnaim, and Zuzim in Ham, and Emim at the Sheva Kitharim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir, as far as the plain of Paran, which is by the desert. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, which is Kadesh. They struck all the territory of the Amalekites and also the Amorites, who dwell in Hazazon-Tamar. And the king of Sodom went forth with the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, which is Zoar, and engaged them in battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Eleazar, 4 kings against 5. The valley of Siddim was full of bitumen wells. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell into them, while the rest fled to a mountain. They seized all the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they departed. And they captured Lot and his possessions, Abram's nephew, and they left, for he was residing in Sodom. Then there came the fugitive and that told Abram, the Ivri, who dwelled in the plains of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol, and the brother of Aner, these being Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his kinsman was taken captive, he armed his disciples who had been born in his house, 318. He pursued them as far as Dan, and he went with his servants, deployed against them at night, and struck them. He pursued them as far as Hobah, which is the north of Damascus. He brought back all the possessions. He also brought back his kinsman, Lot, with his possessions, as well as the women and the people. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him to the valley of Sheveh, which is the king's valley. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God, the Most High. He blessed him, saying, "Blessed is Abram of God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. And blessed be God, the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand." And he gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and take the possessions for yourself." "Abram," said the king of Sodom, "I lift my hand to the Lord God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. If so much as a thread to a shoe strap, or if I shall take anything of yours, so you shall not say, 'It is I who made Abram rich.' Far from me. Only what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who accompanied me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, they will take their portion." Chapter 15. As these events, the words of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am a shield for you, your reward is very great." And Abram said, "My Lord, What can you give me, seeing I go childless, and the suitor of my house is the Damascene, Eliezer? Abram said, see to me, you have given no offspring, and see, my steward inherits me. Suddenly the word of the Lord came to him, saying, that one will not inherit you. Only he that comes from within you shall inherit you. He took him outside and said, gaze now toward the heavens and count the stars if you're able to count them. He said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he trusted in the Lord, and he reckoned to him as righteousness. He said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of Chasdim to give you this land to inherit it. He said, my Lord, whereby shall I know that I am to inherit it? He said to him, take to me 3 heifers, 3 goats, 3 rams, a turtle dove, and a young dove. He took all these to him, he cut them in the center, and placed each piece opposite its counterpart. The birds, however, he did not cut up. The birds of prey descended upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. And it happened as the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, a dread, great darkness fell upon him. He said to Abram, know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. And they will serve them, and they will oppress them 400 years. But also the nation they serve I shall judge, and afterwards they will leave with great wealth. As for you, you shall come to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age, and the fourth generation shall return here. For the iniquity of the Amorite shall not yet be fulfilled until then. So it happened, the sun set, and it was very dark, and behold, there was a smoky furnace and a torch of fire which passed between these pieces. On that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and Jebusite. Chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, see now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing. Consort now with my maidservant. Perhaps I will be built up through her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Abram's dwelling in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Abram, her husband, to him as wife. He consorted with Hagar, and she conceived, and when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. So Sarai said to Abram, the outrage against me is due to you. It was I who gave my maidservant into your bosom, and when she saw that she conceived, I became lowered in her esteem. Let the Lord judge between me and you. Abram said to Sarai, behold, your maidservant is in your hand. Do to her as you see fit. And Sarai dealt harshly with her, so that she fled from her. An angel of the Lord found her by the spring of water in the desert, the spring that rode by to Shur. And he said, Hagar, maidservant of Sarai, where have you come from, and where are you going? She said, I am running away from Sarai, my mistress. An angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress, and submit yourself to her domination. And an angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly increase your offspring, and they will not be counted for their abundance. And an angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you will conceive and give birth to a son. You shall name him Ishmael. The Lord has heard your prayer, and he will be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And over all his brothers he shall dwell. She called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you are the God of vision. She said, could I have seen even here after having seen you? Therefore, the well was called the well of the living one appearing to me. It is between Kadesh and Bered. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son that Hagar bore him, Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Chapter 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am El Shaddai. Walk before me and be perfect. I will set my covenant between me and you, and I will increase you most exceedingly. Abram threw himself upon his face, and God spoke with him, saying, As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations. Your name shall no longer be called Abram, but you shall be called Abraham. Made you father of multiple nations, I will make you the most exceedingly fruitful and make nations of you. Kings shall descend from you. I will ratify my covenant between me and you, between your offspring and after you, throughout their generations as an everlasting covenant, to be a God to you and to your offspring after you. I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourns, the whole land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I shall be a God to them. God said to Abram, As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring, after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male of you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin. That shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. At the age of 8 days, every male among you shall be circumcised throughout your generations. He that is born in the household or purchased with money from any stranger who is not of your offspring. He that is born in your household or purchased with your money shall surely be circumcised. Thus my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. An uncircumcised male who will not circumcise the flesh of his foreskin, that soul shall be cut off from his people, and he has invalidated my covenant. God said to Abraham, As for Sarai, your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. I will bless her. Indeed, I will give you a son through her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of peoples will rise from her. Abram threw himself upon his face and laughed, for he thought, Shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? And shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth? Abram said to God, Oh, that Ishmael might live before you. And God said, Nonetheless, your wife Sarah will bear you a son. You shall call his name Isaac. And I will fulfill my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. But regarding Ishmael, I have heard you. I have blessed him, will make him fruitful, and will increase him most exceedingly. He will beget 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. But I will maintain my covenant through Isaac, whom Sarah will bear you by this time next year. When he had finished speaking with him, God ascended from upon Abraham. Then Abraham took his son Ishmael and all those servants born in his household and all those he had purchased for money, all the male members of Abraham's household. He circumcised the flesh of their foreskin on that very day, as God had spoken with him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised on the flesh of his foreskin. His son Ishmael was 13 years old when he was circumcised on the flesh of his foreskin. On that very day, Abraham was circumcised with Ishmael, his son. And all the people's household, born in his household, and purchased for money from a stranger, were circumcised with him.
That were a very unhappy household.
Very uncomfortable, wasn't it? So that was Lech Lecha. That is Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17. Before I get any spiels or discussing my topics today, are there any questions, comments, things you would like to know? One of you. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, so Abba showed me that in 17:8 and also in 12:7, where you said descendants, the actual proper translation is seed. Mm-hmm. And I go, well, what's seed exactly? And he said the confirmation of the seed is actually in Galatians 3:16.
Correct. We'll discuss that today. Yes.
So that's one thing. I thought that was really cool.
Yep.
Apparently, Haran, the where Terah died, was
yes.
What actually means crossroads?
Yes. It was a... Well, it says a little bit about that, just to give you some details. Okay. God originally asked Terah to leave the Ur of Chaldean, but included in that discussion, which told to us the book of Acts, that Abraham was part of that discussion between Terah and God. So God was talking to Terah as well as Abram at the time, which also includes Nahor and Haran, his brothers, mm-hmm. all of them to leave. So it was this direction, not just to Terah, but to all four men mm-hmm. to leave. But then they reached Haran, and his brother dies. So Terah stays.
Well, his brother died in Ur-Chaldee.
He's buried in Haran, because that's what he's named after.
But Terah is buried in Haran.
Right. Well, they're both there.
Nahor.
They're both there.
Okay, anyway. Let's see. There's a lot of things. Broken down when Abba changed Abram's name Abraham. Mm-hmm. He just added a hey. And if you break down his name by letter, using the Paleo Hebrew.
Yes.
Apparently it means the strength of the house is the head of the waters. Which goes from that to the strength of the house is the head of the open revelation of waters.
Wait, read that again.
Okay, if you break down Abram's name
by
the Paleo, its answer by Paleo is the strength of the house is the head of the waters. That's the meaning. Mm-hmm. And if you break down Abraham, it's the strength of the house is the head of the open revelation of waters. So Abram is a sign of Abba, and Abraham is a sign of Yeshua. I find that cute.
Okay. That's visual. Okay.
Okay. Also something similar with Sarah, but I'm not going to go into that. Oh, and here's really cool. Yitzhak. If you take Yitzhak's name, it's three Hebrew letters. The number for the first letter is 90. The number for the last letter is 100. He was 100. She was 90. Mm-hmm. And the hey means life.
Yes.
Isn't that funny?
Yes. Yeah, that was yes. I wasn't going to cover that today, but you're right. That is how you break down Yitzhak.
And there's a lot more things, but I'll let it fail.
Yeah, when you break every person, every Hebrew name has a numerical value to the spelling, because in Hebrew, unlike English, we have A, B, C, D, E. We also have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that kind of thing. Well, in Hebrew, they don't do that. The letter is a number, a number is a letter, so they're interchangeable. So if you want to say 1, you say Aleph. You also want to say A is Aleph. So it's the same letter for two different things. So you break Yitzhak's name down, that's what it means. From Sarah, from 100 to 90, you get life. Yes?
I also noticed when I was studying a little bit that there probably are chiasms in other chapters, but my eye focused on the one in chapter 17.
Yes.
But there are probably chiasms in every chapter.
There's one in each one of them. I don't believe I'll get to that 17 one today. Yeah. But there is one there, yes. There's one in chapter 12 as well, which I don't know that I'll get to that one either. Chapter 12, I'm sorry, not chapter 12, chapter 13. Yeah. Yes, the chiastic structure is designed to give you attention to things, but I don't think I'll have time to cover. Just realistically, it's labor intensive on what we have to discuss today. But yes, it's the intent is to, in general, either in the middle of a structure or it's a comparison structure to tell you one thing is equal to something else. Well, we might discuss that. I'm not positive yet. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Carrie.
One thing I thought was interesting is this situation with the boys. It looks like the common God taking the second born, except for it's really not. Because you've got two different mothers, and I know there's a law that says that the first mother, her firstborn, is the one that gets the blessing of the firstborn, even if she's not the favored one. So I just made that connection today. It was cool.
Yes, that is. It's important because these two boys and their mothers are a huge aspect of why we're here today. What these two mothers did, and why we're here, why we exist. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Greg.
Right there towards the end at chapter 17, where he decided to wait till the very end to have a covenant with Ishmael.
Oh, yes.
As part of the circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a reason that he waited right till the very end to say, now we're going to have you circumcised, and also this is a covenant with me?
Yeah, there is actually a reason. Yeah, we're going to cover that today. Hopefully, I think I'll get to that one today. I think I have enough time. That's my intent, because it's a big thrust as to why we're discussing this. Yes.
Yeah, this might be a point maybe for next week, but is that later on when Isaac is sacrificed, it talks about bring your son, your only son, and people kind of get thrown off by that because of Ishmael.
Right.
But I heard someone just explain it to this today when I was just reading it again, is that Ishmael is the son of Abram. Isaac is the son of Abraham.
Yes. Distinction, yes. Yes. That is one of we will discuss this in limited form, that God is redefining individuals in this process, which we're going to get to there, I hope, today. Yes, next question.
I noticed some weird stuff with the genealogy. It almost looks like I'm hearing that Terah has two fathers instead of not telling us who the mom is. And at this part, sometimes women, well, usually they're not mentioned at all, but these, I don't know if this is, the daughter was mentioned, but it sounds like she has two fathers.
You're referring to in the
Genesis 11, 20.
It's the tail end of 11, yes, okay.
When Terah.
Yes, they identify who's who, yes.
And twice it was talked about.
Yeah, well, I actually had to cover that a little bit today and go back and discuss a little bit about, okay, about the genealogy, of course, what's going on, but very briefly. I believe I'll be able to cover that today. It's confusing in that there are two Nahors, and there is Haran, and who's married to what is a little confusing.
Yeah.
So we'll discuss that.
Okay.
It's important why it's there.
Oh.
Because it means something to us. Yes.
And after I noticed, I didn't get to finish my genealogy with Jeff's teaching, but I did with you. But everybody started dying a whole lot quicker once,
yes,
Peleg was born.
Yes.
After the earth was divided. And does that mean the language was divided?
It is in my other book. Hold on a minute. Make sure I brought it with me. I did. Woohoo. Yeah, we'll discuss that,
okay,
briefly. you wouldn't be able to see this little chart, but it's on my chart, so I can see it. Discussing what the genealogy, I can let you see it shortly. We'll discuss that also today. That's fine. Any other questions or comments? All right. Well, let's. Oh yes. Oh.
Well, like one thing, like with hopefully you'll be able to explain this with the genealogy. But that's why you have to be careful when if you name every generation the exact same name: William the First, William the Second, William the Third, William the Eighth.
Yes.
After a while, you
it doesn't
are,
work very well. You're right.
I just have one more.
Oh yes, go ahead.
let me find it. What is this tree of Mora? What is this?
It's a place.
You know, I need to write questions down instead of scribbling. I'm going to have to work on my note-taking. I'm really sorry.
Tree of Mora is a place.
Okay. But didn't he go there twice?
I believe he went to Bethel twice.
Twice.
He went to Shechem once. He went to the territory of Hebron. He lived there for years.
And it's always where the trees are.
Yes.
Why is that?
I wasn't intending to talk about trees specifically today, but I can,
okay,
talk about them briefly. in general, because the line of work that Abraham, same man, were in, trees are very important to his line of work. In the forest of animals and everything else, they need that shelter, and so do your citizen, your people that are working with you. They need the trees. But more importantly, trees also indicate fertility of the land you're on. The more trees that are there, that means the nutrients, the grass growing, is higher. So your animals get fatter. They grow better. So again, it also just what he's doing and what his purpose is. Beyond that, It could have been. Beyond the use of trees in a practical sense, they do have symbolic senses too. Because Abraham is supposed to be a righteous man. Well, trees are a representation of righteousness. Each tree has its own qualities and uniqueness, dictates what righteousness quality that tree represents or symbolizes. So, in that respect, Abraham was also a righteous individual because God granted him righteousness because he believed God. So, through his belief, he was granted essentially the tree of all of Israel, and subsequently, all the world. So, because of his established righteousness by his belief. So, trees are symbolic of him in that way.
Well, it's also
desert. Trees are shade, yes. The practical uses of them.
You live by the trees. You're
right. And be aware that trees, of course, are relatively deep-rooted, but if they're alive in a desert environment, they found water. Start digging. Because there's a well nearby. You can make a well there as well. So there's practical reasons why you would want to be near or around trees.
And one more thing about, does somebody want
no,
to
go ahead. Go ahead.
Melchizedek.
Yes.
That is Yeshua. Because I read it and I heard from another, I won't say the name of it, but they were teaching that that was Abba and not Yeshua. So when I asked you about that and you said it was Yeshua, I did cross-referencing, and you're right, it was.
Yeah,
it is Yeshua. He's always been our high priest.
He's always been there. Always been there. That's the point. He is the overseer. He is the caretaker. He is the one who has his hand holding on to Abraham or anybody else's hand, walking through from Adam and Eve all the way through. It's his responsibility. Now, that's not to say that God the Father isn't there. He is. He's the one who makes things happen. As Messiah points out, no one comes to me unless the Father calls me. How's the Father going to call you? He's going to have to talk to you and say, you're going to come to this individual. So God's the Father. He's actively doing everything. But Meshua pointed out that he's the actor, the physical, do the task, do the jobs. And it explains reasonably well, Messiah pointed out that he had to introduce the Father to us because no man knew him. Well, if no man knew him, that means Adam and Eve didn't know him either. Well, who did they know? The only one left. The sound of they knew who was left, the one who talked to them. The Messiah. The Messiah is the one who's involved in this whole process. That's what John chapter 1 discusses. That everything was created by him, or not by him, everything through him and for him, and the word Messiah was there at the very, very beginning, which means when God said, let there be light, there's the Messiah right there. He made sure that happened. So he's responsible for everything God told him to do. Does that make sense? So who you're dealing with from the beginning to end is always the same individual. Who never changes.
Well, I'm working on understanding, so it's hard to.
He's always the same.
I'm getting better at
it. Any other questions? It's good to learn. It's good to discuss. Yes, Anne.
Yes, chapter 17, verse 18, where Abraham says to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. What exactly is Abraham just wanting Ishmael to be the chosen one, or what is this actually mean?
I believe we'll be able to discuss this today because it's part of what. But in a nutshell, Ishmael is the descendant of Abraham. He is one of them. One of the sons of Abraham. Abram, sorry. By biologically, he was Abram at the time. Ishmael is the biological descendant. So he is Abram's technically firstborn, meaning from his loins was Ishmael. That is a great blessing to be the firstborn son. And so Abraham, soon would be known as, wanted or desired that Ishmael would be the fulfillment of what the promise God was agreeing to give. He loved Ishmael. He still loved him. That's part of him. It's part of his son. He raised this boy. So this is a big deal to him for God saying, I'm not going to accept your firstborn child. Because it wasn't from you and Sarah. So it's a difference. So there is an important difference between Ishmael and Isaac and what type of promise each man was given. And we'll discuss that today. It's our intention. And still end at 4. Any questions, other comments I can answer? Okay. We have a quick jump back in chapter 11, just briefly, but not quite yet. We'll discuss this just to hear what's going on. The tail of chapter 11, oh, by the way, Cheryl, I'm sorry, I was incorrect. You're right. Haran was actually killed in Ur, not the place of Ur, not the place of Haran, which is where they dwelled. Yeah, sorry, but I misspoke that one. Terah is the one who's buried there. And Nahor, obviously, is buried there too, because he stays there along with Milcah. Going back to chapter 11 briefly, just tail end of this. This is starting in verse 26. When Terah had lived 70 years, Terah is Abram's father, lived 70 years, begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now these are the chronicles of Terah. Terah begot Abraham, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran begot Lot. Haran died in the lifetime of Terah, his father, in his native land of Ur, Chasadim. And Abram and Nahor took themselves wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took his son, Abram, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and daughter-in-law Sarai, and the wife of Abram's son, and they departed with them from Ur of Chasidim to go to the land of Canaan. They arrived at Haran, where they settled. The days of Terah were 205 years old, and Terah died in Haran. Brief discussion of who's who here. So Abram has three brothers. One of his brothers marries the daughter of Haran, the other brother. So, which is not a big problem at this time in history. Nahor marries his brother's daughter. Yes, it's his niece. Nahor marries his niece, Milcah. Now that's important because that's where the line of Rebekah comes from. And Rachel and Leah, they all come from that line, from Milcah and Nahor. So it's important we need to know who's who and Abraham and Nahor took themselves wives. This is verse 29. And it says, the tale ends, and it says, Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, who's the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. Now, Milcah is Haran's daughter who married Nahor, her uncle. Does that make sense?
Her brother?
Yes. Yes. Do I draw a family tree?
Yeah, draw it.
Yeah, draw a real quick tree. So you got Terah. Now, I'm abbreviate with initials. He has three sons, Abraham, Nahor, and Haran. Now, Terah also has many daughters. And he has multiple wives. So there's no indication that Abraham, Nahor, or Haran were from the same woman. They can be from different. They can be different women because that's not a problem. Because Terah also has a daughter named Sarai from a different wife than Abram was married. So actually, I should draw this on the other side. Makes more simpler. Sarah over here. So Sarah and Abram have Isaac. All right. Haran has two daughters and a son. He has Milcah, Iscah, and Lot. Nahor marries Milcah and has how many children involved? I don't remember, but you got Laban and his sister Rebekah, and I'm not sure who else is involved in that. But Rebekah and Isaac are the ones who actually wind up getting married, and they, of course, have Jacob and Esau. Make sense? Yes.
Why did they only list certain individuals? Why did they list certain individuals from lines, but then they say we had sons and daughters and don't keep track of the others? But it's like they're marking a place.
They're marking people in particular in time and history because they are the reason or the influence of something that happens later on. So, for example, I'm not saying this for certain, but it is probably true. You notice when Cain was having children, this child, that child, and went down from generation to generation, the tail end, it stops at Tubal-Cain, and it mentions his sister, Naamah. Jewish tradition specifies that Naamah and Noah were husband and wife. So Naamah being the mother of Shem, Japheth, Ham, and Japheth. Yeah, I get the order, I get it mixed up. So she's the only daughter mentioned anywhere. Why would they mention that? Because she's important. She means something. Thus, this is the meaning. It's most likely that she and Noah had married and they had their three kids. Now, because we don't specify ages along Cain's line, but age is given, of course, in Seth's line. So these women are all mentioned at different times. And don't forget, along Laban's line, I should have drawn Laban on the other side of their R. So I'll put Laban over here. He has many children too. Remember, he has obviously two daughters, four daughters. There's two daughters plus the two concubines slash daughters. They're also his descendants, but they're from second, third, or fourth wives. However many wives he has, I don't really know. But he has daughters, and of course, I'm not going to draw them all up. But it continues on for many generations, including where Job shows up on the scene. Job. He's from the same family. They're all the same family. They're all relatives. So they're all mentioned because they mean, they are part of our Bible story. So any name in there did something, whether it even tells you or not, did something in the story to be part of it. So God wants to mention by, like, a honorable mention of names. So-and-so is somebody really important. Let's, even Jesus, when the woman with the oils and things she did, he said, she'll be remembered from this point on. Why? Because she did something kind. And it was something, obviously it was symbolic too, but it was kind too as well. And so because of that, she gets an honorable mention. Whether she does anything else in her life, who cares? She gets her honorable mention because she did something. So everybody here mentioned did something good or bad. They did something, hopefully mostly good, but there are a few bad guys in there too. So they all have reasons. And keep in mind, also remember, that as far as who marries what in all family lines, this is not modern day. This is not post-Moses with Torah and who gets to marry what.
So I don't think it was really that necessary for them to interbreed like that.
You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. It has been a number of years, but it's not that far. I've got a chart here to show you. Go ahead, Tammy.
Well, one of the reasons that this family is the way they are is because this family of Terah, this is the first family of monotheism.
Yes. They are believers in a single God. Well, other than Noah himself.
Other than Noah, but, you know... Right. So that I think is why that they kept so closely together is because they basically, in a lot of ways, are the first family of monotheism.
Yep. It's a monotheism, but to believe that there is one God, one creator.
Because after Noah died, most of them
went their own
chose
ways.
To reject El
right.
Shaddai.
Yes. Yeah.
Did the Ham people?
Yeah, most of all of them did. All of them did. Bear in mind, we're talking this events are roughly 400 years after the Great Flood. So you go from 8 people at the Flood to 400 years past. There are many people, but they've also then died too. And fighting has happened, and people have spread around, and they've traveled from place to place, and they're scattering about from the Tower of Babel and everything else happening along here too. So the Tower of Babel, by the way, is only occurring at about, 50 years earlier. So it's not that much time has lapsed from many major world events. And so, genealogy-wise, genetic problems of so-and-so marrying so-and-so isn't a big concern. Adam and Eve, of course, and their children all married each other. They had to marry their own siblings. There's nature of how this stuff works. So it's not a problem, per se. Now, you will notice, not in this reading, but the next reading section, it is important at their time that the mothers not be the same mom. So there, at time of Abraham, when he was a child or a young man, they recognized that the mothers must be biologically different. They could be the same father, but the mother had to be different for marriage to happen. So it's not, they are recognizing that there are problems from sibling to sibling. So there has to be a degree of separation occurring. At least at this point, 50-50 blend. You can't have more than 50% of the same parent. So they're recognizing these things. They're coming to them as people are learning and what is acceptable, what's not acceptable. Make sense? Anything else?
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm here to answer any questions you've got as best I can answer it.
May I hold that for a minute? When Abba is talking to Abraham in Genesis...
Which point?
15. I know we're not there, but
okay.
I need to know why did he give him that premonition of Joseph being enslaved? And at that time, was a generation 100 years, or is it every 10 years?
Well, technically neither.
So then what was the whole thing about him bringing a scary darkness upon him? Why bring the ovens? And then he had to do a three-year-old, he had to sacrifice a three-year-old ram and a three-year-old female goat, but he wasn't to hurt the birds.
Well, they didn't cut the birds in half. They still died. They were sacked, but they weren't cut in half like the others were.
So what was that all about? Why the... Is that another question?
I can address this, I believe, but I don't know if I have time to address it fully.
But
I'll do my best to talk to you. Well, I'll do my best to say it right now. Each animal has its own respective purpose of symbolism.
And your dad has a talk on that on the website.
Yes, he discusses it very well on our website. He discusses in great detail what each animal means, its purpose, and its objective. So you'll notice in the sacrificing time when discussing Leviticus, it has association for each person, a type of person. You have a specific type of sacrifice that corresponds to your place. For example, princes or kings have a more expensive sacrifice, so do high priests versus the ordinary commoners. So each group has its own function, its own purpose, and female goat has one application, if I recall correctly. Even an infant, like an unweaned goat has, or animal has applications too, though it's usually not common. So they each have their purpose. If they have a purpose assigned to them in Leviticus, then their symbolism is probably always true. Which means if a high priest, for example, or a king or a prince has to sacrifice a cow or a goat or something, or a cow, for example, for a sin or a transgression or whatever else they want to do, that association is there. It stays constant. So each of these animals being sacrificed, sliced up and divided up and fire going through them, associates or has matching to a type of descendant Abraham's going to have. We're not just, these aren't sin sacrifices. These are different sacrifices. These are offerings. Abraham did not address any sin offerings. That is not his job. God purposely did not want him to do that. That would backfire horribly later on if he did. So it's important Abraham did not sacrifice any sin offerings. So he didn't. These are not sins. These are strictly an agreement, a covenant agreement between Abraham and God, which means, with all these animals, it was inclusive of Abraham's descendants as well. They are part of this agreement, that God would walk them through their generations to come. Yes?
But usually the animals
are 3 years old. Right. Why is it three? Why are you 3 years old instead of one?
Why 3 years old?
Yes, why 3 years old? I can only give that a partial answer because I only have a partial one. Clearly, the number three in death always, always associates with Messiah somewhere in the Bible. If you see the number three, or 33, or 300, or number three anyway, any orientation, and life and death scenario in the same picture, you are looking at Messiah in some way or another. Alright, because it's associated with 3 days and 3 nights in the grave, and of course from going from death to life. So it's symbolic of that. So the three, what was that? In his age, everything associated with three in death and life is always a picture of Messiah in your Bibles. So when you look at that and you see the years of three and all these animals associated to it, they are tying these symbolic generations to a, as I mentioned earlier by Cheryl, a seed. A particular individual. And that individual, of course, is Messiah. So each of these generations, each of these types of people are being carried through or lived through, will continue on through until that seed comes about. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's continue on a little bit further. I'll get past, I'm not even in chapter 12 yet. I actually went to chapter 11 first. Okay, let's go.
But yes. Our reading started in the middle.
Mine did not. Mine started in chapter 12, verse 1.
Well, the parashah starts at 12.
That's 12:1.
Oh, never mind.
Okay, that's 12:1. That's okay.
Left off in the middle of the
yes, last week, Jeff, he covered certain things, but he wasn't able to cover the genealogy question that you had up today. Okay, let's get going here. So, because the agreement was given to Terah, Abraham, and all of Abraham's brothers, and Lot included, when Haran died, and God goes to Abram and says, hey, continue on, go out. The agreement was originally with Terah and his whole family. Of course, Terah stays, Nahor stays, Haran dies, Lot goes with. So, the original agreement includes Lot. The original agreement from Terah, with God to Terah, includes Lot. Lot was intended, God intended Lot and Terah and all of his sons to make it from where they were, Ur of Chaldea, all the way to Canaan. That was the intention. That was the goal. That was the objective. Terah was supposed to go too. The original agreement was all of them. All the men were supposed to, with of course their households, their women, their servants, all of them were supposed to go. Terah, Nahor, Abram, they all stopped in Haran. They stopped there. They did not complete the journey. For lots of reasons, some people argue this or that. I'm not going to discuss the reasons as to why. But the point is, so when God calls Abram after Terah's, or near Terah's death, he's not actually dead yet, he's still alive, towards the tail end of Terah's life, calls Abram, so you will come with. Abram is finishing off the agreement God made with his whole family, and Lot wants to go with, too, to finish off the agreement to travel or follow God. So Lot was a monotheist as well. Yes.
I don't know where you've read that at.
Which
because
part?
It's not in Scripture where God made an agreement with these guys, because it looks from my reading that after the father died, that's when Abba approached Abraham about moving on.
Go to Acts chapter 7.
Huh?
Acts chapter 7. Now this is Stephen's speech. Acts chapter 7, starting in verse 1. Now, of course, in the middle of Stephen's being interrogated, about to be executed, but this is, we're not going to cover this whole speech, but just the first part of his speech explains a little bit of detail what's happening. Which means when God first spoke to Terah and said to go out, Stephen explains more to that. It says starting in verse 1. Then the high priest said, are these things so? They're questioning Stephen, the people who witnessed against him. Now Stephen said, men, brethren, fathers, listen. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran. So he's explaining that back when they're in Ur of Chaldea, God is addressed our father Abraham, which means he's included in the address that God actually records in chapter 11 to Terah. He said to him, get out of your country from your relatives and come to a land that I will show you. He came out of the land of the Chaldeans, dwelt in Haran, and from there, when his father was dead, he moved him to this land which you now dwelt. God gave him no inheritance in it, not even enough to set his foot on, but even Abraham no child, he promised to give it to him for possession and to his descendants thereafter. But God spoke in this way that his descendants would sojourn in a foreign land. They would bring them to bondage and oppress them 400 years. So that in the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, says God, and after that they should come out and serve me in this place. He gave them the covenant of circumcision, and so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day, and Isaac, of course, begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. We're not going to go through any further. The point is, in his first address, we're discussing this point, he points out that when Abraham's still in Ur of Chaldeans, when Terah and everybody else travels out, he's saying that God called Abraham before he reached Haran. So that means Abraham was included in when God spoke to Terah. So he addresses that if Abraham's included with Terah, and Lot also continues with Abraham, which is, of course, the grandson, which is Lot's, or Abraham's nephew, also traveled with him. That means God spoke to at least three men, which includes Terah, Abraham, or Abram at the time, and Lot. It would be obvious he's following along with his family. So all those three men, which includes, since Nahor went with them, up to Haran, he was probably included in this discussion, in this agreement. So his monotheism was growing in this particular family pretty well. So that answers the question?
Yeah.
So that's how these men were all called, not just one, it was all of them called. And they all went to certain degrees. It was important, in my opinion, that Nahor stayed behind in Haran.
Why?
Because otherwise, because we need Rebecca to show up. We need Rachel and Leah to show up. They need to have their monotheistic beliefs way back then and keep with them, although granted Rachel had gods and other stuff happened. It got messy with Laban's descendants. I won't discuss him and his quality of life. But with regards to the rest of the, they needed that line to stay theologically decent to pull from as needed, because they're going into a territory where all Canaanites and the others were showing up, Perizzites showing up too. They're all polytheists of every sort you can think of. So they need people that they can continue on to refresh or maintain a family belief in a single creator God. Okay? So it's important that Nahor stayed behind to do that. So he created a good service.
Is that why all the altars were necessary in the different directions? Because
directions. Explain direction. What do you mean?
Well, he went here and he built an altar.
Oh, to build one, different places.
And then he went to the west and built an altar.
Different places, yeah.
And there was only three that I read, not four. So I don't know if there was one in all.
There's one, two. There were two he built, and where he lived, yeah. So and then, of course, Isaac gets his fourth altar. So there's a fourth altar there. When Isaac is almost offered him one. Yeah. When you have polytheistic cultures and altars to every god you can imagine, they're made a particular way, whatever that person decided that God wanted, they made their way and their methods. You don't use them. They are dedicated to something that is not of the Creator. So when Abram shows up, and he says, okay, here is a polytheistic society, I am not to be part of them, build my own separate, distinct existence with God. That's pretty consistent through the Bible. They'll discuss that. When you start something new, go into a place that is not of God, clean it up and start fresh, so to speak. Restart it. What you would do that for? You buy a new house. What do? You dedicate it. You clean all the garbage that's there, and you rededicate it. This is God's house, not whatever it was before. Who knows what it was before? I don't know. But that's what you would normally do. It's no different than Abraham when he showed up. Yeah. Same process.
At this time, we have not built a sukkah yet. We have not gotten into the Jewish...
None of the holy days are defined. None of the sacrifices are defined. None of that's defined. Now, to be fair, the holy day symbolisms come from the patriarchs, from their lives. And they come from Adam and Eve. They come from elements that happened during their lives. Those symbolisms are used at that time. They're brought all the way forward to Moses' time, which they're put into these holy days cycles. So they're there, quote, there, end of quote, and loosely. Their symbolism exists, but the actual activity is not part of it. Okay? Yes, Cheryl.
So maybe I missed this answer, but I'm trying to understand how if Haran and Nahor and Terah and Abram and all them were included in going to Canaan, then why would Abram be told, leave your father's house?
I don't know if we'll get to that, but we might. I can try to answer it now, but it won't be a very strong one yet because it's not finished. But I might get it by the end of the day. I'm not positive. But in general, Terah, Nahor, all their family, they stop at a certain spot. To leave their families, leave your father, leave your relatives behind. It's because that's not the promised land that he had in mind, that God was intending for Terah and his descendants. Right. So he said, where your family has stopped, leave them behind. And finish off to the promised land that I agreed to you, that I wanted to show you, all the way to Canaan. So they leave your father's household, leave them, leave Terah, leave, or she's died, dead now, leave Nahor, leave everybody else that's there, Haran's dead, Nahor's still alive. Leave them behind, don't stay with them, and continue on your journey, even though you're 35 years old now. You've been there for 20 some odd years. No, there's nothing wrong with Lot going the second time, because since Lot was part of Haran's descendancy, and Terah was told to get out, Terah knew the rules. Terah knew what God was intending. As it says, Terah begot Abraham and died, twives. 31. Terah took his son Abraham, Lot's grandson, to daughter Lot, wife Abraham. They all departed with him to go to the land of Canaan. That was the objective, but they never made it. So Terah didn't make it to Canaan, which means Lot, who Terah was bringing with him, was intended in Terah's mind to make it to Canaan. Nahor was intended in Terah's mind to make it to Canaan. So was Abram. So when Terah didn't make it, he stopped at Haran and stayed there instead. He changed his mind, whatever, I don't really care. But Lot knew that it was the intent to go to Canaan. That was his grandfather's intent. So when... No, leave what your father's house means. Leave what is staying here. Leave it behind.
Property,
because anything that's there, leave it behind. Nahor, leave behind. Milcah, leave behind. Leave that descendancy behind. Whatever is their property, leave behind, and continue on your travels. Lot agreed, because of course Lot was the inheritor of Haran's possessions, which of course means 1/3 of Terah's possessions, was all with him too. So, basically, a third of their stuff stays behind. A third of the people, a third of everything stays behind. Okay? And then the remaining 2/3 moves on. Make sense? Israel. Modern day Israel. It's a little bigger than technically modern day Israel, but it's that territory. You go from north of Carmel, the Phoenician territory, all the way through until you reach the Amorites, which is the southern end of Israel, southern desert of Israel. So Canaan, that territory. Okay, move a little forward first. I might get past chapter 12 today. I don't know. That's okay. No, don't worry about it. The point, which now let's actually get into chapter 12. So what was the agreement? God made some promises to Abraham in chapter 12. What was his promises? He made a bunch of them. I will briefly go through them. Genesis 12. The first part. This is an agreement. First, God spoke to Abram when he's pulled to 12. This is what he says. Get out of your country of your kindred, your father's house, to the land I will show you. Now, here are the agreements. Agreement number one, verse 2. I will make you a great nation. That's the first agreement God makes. Second agreement, I will bless you. Third agreement, I will make your name great. Fourth agreement, you will be a blessing. The fifth, I will bless those who bless you. And sixth, I will curse him who curses you. And the seventh, you will be a and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All these are the agreements that God made to Abraham if you continue on your journey that Terah started. So what did Abraham do? He did it. It's a deal. I'll do it. Now, of course, he was instructed to go. The word go means, or to go for yourself, it literally means go for your personal benefit. Go for your personal gain. It is for your benefit. It's on your best interest to go do this. In verse 1, it says go for yourself. It means go in order to get where you need to get. It is best for you to do this. And of course, he does so, obviously, in Terah, and everybody else stays behind. Or Terah's dead now, but stays behind. In the first agreement, to a land I will show you, where does he bring him? Well, he brings immediately, the first part of the agreement was to, and discusses, of course, in verse 6. He passed into the land as far as the site of Shechem, which is roughly the middle part of Canaan. I'll draw a little map here. I'll move my board over because it makes life simpler. I don't have to walk so hard. Not that I'm lazy, but it's hard for you guys to see. Erase that. Oops. Canaan. So, Israel, right? That's basically Israel. So where's Shechem? Right about here. I'll abbreviate. Okay, I'm not a good speller. Shechem's there. Jerusalem's down here. Actually, it's a little further north, and that's a little too far south. So right about here. Shechem's there. Jerusalem's about here. Hebron's about here. Put a little H. Put Jerusalem just for reference, because we all of us know and heard of Jerusalem. So Hebron's about here. So Abraham comes down. He travels through. Bethel and Ai are right about here and here. They're right next to each other, where he builds a second altar. So Abraham comes through. What route he took, I don't really care. He's crossing through. There's a mountain range along Israel. Those who've been to Israel, you see the mountain range, right? It's a long one. It's pretty big. There are passes here and there, but it's mountainous territory. However he got to Shechem, most likely, because there's a valley, through here. There's a valley in that direction. It's pretty relatively, it's hard, not too hard to travel. So he's coming down from Haran all the way down through this territory. Where is Sodom and Gomorrah? Well, no one knows for certain, per se, but they're somewhere in the Dead Sea territory. Some argue here, some argue there, some sit down here. Who cares? The point is, that's where Sodom and Gomorrah are. They're the Dead Sea, so let's accept that. So he travels here, he goes to Shechem. He leaves Shechem after he builds his first altar, which is his first introductory to the land of Canaan, by the way, is Shechem. That comes up later with Jacob and his descendants. He leaves there and goes to Bethel and Ai. That shows up again later on with Joshua, and they enter in, and there's a big battle, and things happen in Bethel. It also, however, importantly to remember, shows up with Jacob when he's fleeing his brother Esau. He stops at Bethel and builds another altar there. That's an important territory, important place. Bethel means house of God. So that is what it symbolically means. So Abraham starts here and says, with this altar in Shechem, I am claiming this territory. That God has shown me this is where he wanted me to stop. So he travels and God, of course, and says, this is the whole area I will give to you. He goes to Bethel and Ai, puts a tent between them. There's two little mountains there. Another altar there. Bless God. Speaks to him again. He then travels down. He obviously travels all the way down eventually to Egypt. Egypt down there, of course, comes back again. But he dwells or hangs out mostly in Hebron. Hebron is not that far from the northern area of where Sodom and Gomorrah most likely are. Which means when he looks out from his tent and the big smoke rising, he gets to see it. Hi, he's on a mountaintop. And where's Sodom and Gomorrah? On the other side of a valley. He gets to see it. And when Lot says, where should I live? And Lot says, well, mountains, valley. Which does Lot choose? The valley. better place, right? Lots of water, lots of good stuff there. General territory, what's happening? So Abraham travels here. He lives or hangs out mostly in Hebron. Okay, so where are we at here? First part, so God agreed to show it to the territory, and he does so in verses 6 through 9. Of course, obviously does his various altars there. The next agreement, I will make you a nation, a great nation. Well, this promising, this starting promise, of course, starts out in verse 10. And the process of which he is almost, as he first comes in, this great famine, of course, has to leave. Now, we don't know how long he's been there, but probably a very short period of time. He has to leave from there straight to Egypt, which is symbolic of, obviously, Jacob, the family of Jacob, Israel, going down to Egypt the same way as Messiah went down to Egypt. So there's all the same symbolism going through here in order to get to safety. Jacob, when he was alive, and he's going down with his sons, the 70 people, they're going down to Egypt because there's food there. They need safety. So that's where the safety is at. Safety is in Egypt. So they had food there for Jacob and his family. Of course, all of Israel had to flee Egypt later on as Pharaoh escorted them out. I like the word escort. Escorted them out with chariots at that time. But escorted them out later. So this symbolic, Abraham's actions are symbolic of Messiah's actions as well. So when, I forgot who it was, something about Aloft, that Abraham is a type of Messiah, he is, just like Melchizedek is as well. Their actions are symbolic of God and symbolic of what Messiah is doing or has done. Let's go continue on here. So he continues on through, because it makes you a great nation. In what way is verse, we'll go from verse, 10 onward through all of verse 20. What in that part of chapter 12 makes Abraham great or starts making him a great nation in particular? What does he gain? Lots and lots of wealth. Donkeys, camels, everything else he gets. Maid, servants, slaves, the whole works. He gets a lot of wealth that way. But that does not make a great nation. But it's part of it. And it explains how large he is being made. Great, where great doesn't mean lofty. Does not mean some superior moral nation. That wasn't that was great. Means size. It means scope and strength of wealth, the strength of power. That's what great in this term means. We'll discuss the lofty part later, which is part of the promise. Yes.
Would what happened to Pharaoh be a part of his?
It is part of the. Bless you, and curses who curse you. With Pharaoh and later on with Abimelech, it's the same thing. The curse those who curse you. And Pharaoh and Abimelech both received a cursing from God on Abraham and Sarah's behalf. So, and they weren't, those people weren't trying to curse them, per se. They weren't, Pharaoh didn't come out and say, curse you, Abraham, or Abimelech didn't come out and curse you, Abraham. That wasn't the case. At least not initially. They were quite happy to have them come. But the point is that Abraham had to go through a very a difficult role to make this happen. He did not believe, in my opinion, that these people were going to kill him because he was just a paranoid man. They saw how beautiful she was, even at 90-year-old woman. Yes. She, well, if Abraham was 35, then she'd be at least 65 or older.
She's 9 years younger than
him. Yeah, 9 to 10 years younger. So the exact birth dates is hard to say. So, That she's obviously a fairly attractive lady, and he wouldn't fear for his life without good reason. So these men probably would have killed him had they had the opportunity or thought so. Yes.
Well, people back then aged a lot more slowly than
they
do now.
Yes. 125, if you, or Tara, 205 years old. Well, the average person here dies, like 75, 80, whatever. So do the math. She's probably equivalent in her 30-40s-ish on her age appearance, as we would consider today. Give or take. I'm not saying exactly, but give or take. Yes. I'll do my best. Go ahead.
Okay, it says that they acquired slaves. Now, are these slaves in the mannerism that we would know what a slave is today, or is this an indentured servant that owes somebody money, or is this a full-on slave?
Let's see here. I can do my best to answer this one.
Right.
What Americans, and so do most modern Western culture people, perceive as slaves is not what the Bible defines as a slave. We think of slaves as your personal beating toy. That's what you do what you want, whether you like, don't like it, I beat you till you die. That's what we think of as slavery. That's not God's definition of slavery. God's definition of slavery has two aspects to it. There's a permanent slave and a temporary one. The permanent slave is the one, a permanent slave by choice. They choose to be your permanent slave. What would make somebody permanently want to be your slave? You have to be treat them really well. Yeah, you have a desire to treat them really well. And they must like you and want to serve you. You're a good master. So that's a permanent slave by choice. Then there's a temporary slave by debt. I'm a slave to you until my debt's paid, and then I go all my own way. So two different types of slaves. Now, I cannot speak to how Pharaoh ruled his household and for our servants are concerned. But in Abraham's time, the rules of what slavery should or shouldn't be are not defined as they are in Torah with Moses yet. But the way Abraham lived his life appears that the slaves he had, who were all willing to go to war for him and enjoy the spoils of their war, they must have liked him. So he's probably a good master, most likely. He also trained them to do war. So they obviously have their use. He also acquired new slaves while he was there. So he is not an evil or rotten master in any way. So even if they were, and particularly those born in his house, by the way, belong to Abraham, those are not slaves by choice, per se. Those slaves forever until Abraham decides to do something else with them. That's the nature of a born servant. But they are Abraham's possession to do as he wishes, but not treat them horribly. Now, in the Bible, we have specific rules on how you treat slaves. They are not like we think of slaves. They're what we think of as a servant, a hired servant. We would treat them similarly. What does a hired servant do today if you mistreat them? You get sued. Bad things happen to you for screwing up, so don't screw up. Yes, Tammy.
And also, with the American or the, you know, that time period experience of slavery, those folks were kidnapped, which is a death penalty offense in Torah.
Itself. Yes.
You kidnap a particular group of people to put them into slavery. That was a death penalty offense in Torah.
Yes. The whole process of which modern day. But what slavery was back in the 1800s and 1700s and a few hundred years before that is not what God defined as slavery. Not intended in any way, shape, or form. That's what man defined as slavery. Because we like the dominant. As your commander. Yeah, you have to keep stuff.
These guys were building
their own households. Right.
And their own riches and wealth. I mean, it was a totally different setup than what we think of in Western.
God has to have a different idea of what vibrating.
Yeah, God defines his idea.
Yeah, God is not an American.
No, he's not. No, he's not an American. Let's continue on forward, please. Let's see. So, Abraham acquired things, but that wasn't where he makes you a great nation. And in chapter 13, it explains what that result was. Great nation defined as size. In 13 verses, the first 14 verses, which means almost the whole chapter, it discusses the size or scope of Lot's possessions and the size of Abraham's possessions. They were too much. The territory couldn't support them anymore. So their greatness, their size, was growing. Clearly God blessed them. He said, I'll make you a great nation. Now, nation obviously employs many, many people. Abraham isn't many people yet. But this is still a symbol or part of the fulfillment of his promise. Continue on, the next blessing says, God says, I will bless you. Now, the blessing of God, I'm not going to run through all the whole chapter. We already read it once. Chapter 14, what kind of blessing did Abraham get when he went up against those kings? What did he gain from it? What was the blessing? He got to be Melchizedek. That's true.
Sorry.
What did Melchizedek say his blessing was? Verse 19. Blessed is Abram, God of God, the Most High, maker of an earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand. So what blessing... is when it says, I will bless you, God be with you, I will bless you. What blessing was Melchizedek pointing out to Abraham, or Abram at the time? What was the blessing?
That he delivered him, he fought his war, brought in,
right.
He conquered them.
How can 318 men take out what looks like probably in the multiple thousands? In the thousands of people.
He defeated four kingdoms.
Right, with 318 guys.
But he did the same thing with what I was sharing with my kids. Where he likes those odds.
Yes, he does. And is that a blessing?
Yes.
Yes, that's a blessing. So did God bless him? Yes, he blessed him beyond what we would think of as impossible. Now I realize obviously Gideon did something somewhat similar. But Gideon didn't really fight so much as the other men fought themselves. He just scared them away. God did all the work. So in this instance, this great blessing which Sodom, Gomorrah, and the other kings could not accomplish with their armies, Abram did it with 318 servants. Three, 318, I think, shows up twice, but I don't recall the second one it shows up at. I'd have to look it up again. I don't remember. What I want to point out to you, though, is in Abraham's benefit, is he's from the territory that these kings are coming from. Abraham's from Ur of Chaldea. He's about 48-ish years old when he leaves. No, he's 75 when he leaves Haran. He's 48 years old, so before he leaves from Ur to get to about 48, 49, somewhere in the range, to get to Haran. And all these kings are in territories and conquered lands that Abram grew up in. You think he knows something about them? He probably does. Yes.
It's my understanding that Amraphel, A-M-R-A-P-H-E-L, is actually another name for Nimrod.
You know, I won't say that for certain. It could be. I do not know. There's a Jewish tradition that argued that he could have been, but I just don't know because they couldn't demonstrate why they thought that. They just thought it. And that's one of the drawing. Yes, he probably would still be alive, or his child would still be alive. Yeah, so it's hard to say for certain if he was part of it or not. I won't say he is. It's conceivable, though. Yes.
So what you're saying is that technically Abram committed an act of treason?
Yes. He went against his own biological, not family, but biological country. He's from there. He knows those men. Not necessarily a person by name, but he knows the culture, which means he probably knows the military tactics too.
So he defeated those kings to get his family back.
Back, right. To get Lot back, and all the people too. But he defeated those kings. So I would suspect he probably knew attacking by night was going to work. Just a guess, but I don't know for certain. But Abraham would have been alive in his approaching 50 years old when he's leaving that territory. And so Abraham, by the way, was alive at the time of the Tower of Babel. So Abraham, he was alive and well when the Tower of Babel was being built. So Abraham was part of this, not necessarily part of building it, but the point is he was part of that culture, that area, when the Tower of Babel was being built. And the great nation be escaped, or scattered. Abraham was alive and well when that happens. He's about 50, about that time when the Tower of Babel collapses and everything, all this mess happens. So it could be, since we're talking, you know, roughly what, 10-ish years later, give or take, that Abram knew these men,
wow,
possibly by either by name or by reputation. Actually, about 25 years later, give or take, maybe thereabouts. He probably knew some of these guys. Could be. So yeah, a type of treason. Let's move on. So, great blessing. So, Melchizedek points out his great blessing was that God delivered into your hand all these great things. And Abraham then quickly points out to King of Sodom, when Sodom says, give me the people that keep your stuff, Abraham says, no way, I don't want any of your stuff. Your stuff is from a thread to a sandal strap. So Abraham knows that the wickedness of Sodom is not where his blessing comes from. The great wealth Sodom has acquired was not to be Abraham's or even associated to in any way. Lot, on the other hand, different story. We're discussing Abraham in particular. Yes.
Just quickly.
Go ahead.
The kings were asking for 5 Hebrew men. Why?
King,
or
five,
did I miss?
Wait, say that,
did
say,
I miss
say
that?
Say that sentence again. What did you say?
There
were 4 men against 5.
Yeah, but weren't they asking for the Hebrew men, the kings?
Eber. In verse 13, the fugitive came and told Abraham, Hebrew, or something you might explain, who dwelt in the plains of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother, all the people too, Abraham's allies, or even allies. The fugitive, which means somebody who escaped the battle, whatever happens. Now, there were many people who escaped. Obviously, the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah escaped in the Butman pits or wells, and so the people ran the mountains to survive. So one of them, whoever ran the mountain, is a general area, the mountains from plains to mountains, they all ran toward Abram's direction, because that's he's in the mountains. So they all ran to him to tell him what had happened to Lot and what happened to him. So they knew that whoever that was sent knew these men up here were powerful, had strength behind them, and they might be able to help do something, whatever it was. Now, I don't know how many soldiers these kings down here had in the valley. Who knows? Hundreds, thousands, I don't know. They had something. Obviously, they didn't win. So, but they figured that these men up top, who had great wealth of property, of animals, of money, everything you imagine, they had abundance of it, they could probably do something about it and make this problem get fixed. And that was the intent or the desire from this fugitive. I'm not going to have time to go through very many chapters. I'm sorry. It's already 4 o'clock. So I'm going to end this relatively quickly. I'll give you a few more details about the remaining chapters, and then we'll move forward or move on. I want to point out that, as it was spoken of earlier, I'm not going to read it myself. You're welcome to read it to yourself. Hebrews chapter 7, the whole chapter discusses the details of Melchizedek and what he is and what his symbolism is and how he and Messiah are tied one and the same. The distinction in Hebrews 7 points out that unlike the biblical priesthood, which was biological descendancy, Messiah's priesthood is by agreement or by oath. It is an agreement. I will do this. And that's how it works. Now, Hebrews also points out, which I love this part, that the original priesthood was assigned to men who would live and who would die. And of course, Messiah's priesthood doesn't die. But yet Messiah died all at the same time. And that explanation was great because it explains how, because in the Torah it explains when a person makes a mistake, a sin, causes some horrible thing, and they are doomed to die or have to go to trial, they must go to a refuge city until the high priest dies. And that's the agreement. The high priest dies, that person is now innocent. So, being the Messiah, him dying, that means any person who creates a sin worthy of death in that respect, because Messiah dies, your high priest now dead, you're now innocent. It's a great symbolism how that worked. It was beautiful. Because that's how God had intended it to be. So, Messiah being a dead, that your high priest dies for each of your sins that you screw up with, and of course, you better fix them from that point on, improve your life. It is the same symbolism as the physical high priest when Aaron was born, or lived. When they died, the people who were all in these refuge cities were all then set free to go live their lives however much years they had left. So that was the intent and the symbolism behind it. I think Hebrews did a really good job explaining that. You can read it yourself as you wish. And who Melchizedek was. In the next part of God's promise, I will make your name great. This is an important part, which is why every one of us pretty much are here today, actually. This is a profound event in chapter 15. Points out in verses 5 through 6. He took him outside, God did. Gaze now to the heavens, count the stars, you're able to count them. He said to him, so shall your offspring be. And he trusted in the Lord, it reckoned to him as righteousness. His trust, which is faith. Faith equals trust, trust equals faith. So, trust in the Lord. That trust Abraham had granted him righteousness. How do you get righteousness? By trusting God. Is it by any of your actions?
Well, yeah, you obey him.
But see, yeah, that's the detail. It's not by actions of out of law, meaning the Torah's actions, which is what Romans explains, chapter 4. It's not through your actions of obeying the law. That's the law is designed for you to live by. That's you do this, do this, don't do that, don't do that. That's how you live your bodies, live your life. That doesn't give you the kingdom of heaven. It doesn't give you into God's kingdom. The trust, the faith gets you there. You have to go beyond the action of this, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. Go past the Torah part, because that's not going to get you there. That just gives you your flesh and blood life. You have to believe that he exists. You have to trust and believe not just in God, but believe God. There's a difference. You can believe in him, but not believe him. You understand? You can believe in, but not believe what he says. That doesn't work. Believe in him, but also believe him too. What he said, what he agreed to, what the promise was, which Abraham was granted, or not granted, sorry, Abraham was told, that he would grant this great promise to be given to him. Did Abraham receive the promise?
No.
Not at all. He died. Did he get this perfect land he was promised from with Terah onward? No, he didn't. Did his descendants get it? No, they didn't. No one got it. No one got it. They all lived, they all died. So they didn't get it, but they all still trusted him in spite of the fact they did not get or receive the promise. We discussed this back when we were discussing it at Sukkot. That they all knew that this life, the Torah, anything else they're living by, is a temporary place. It's an existence. You don't belong here. We don't belong here. I don't belong here. No one here belongs here. The agreement was that Abraham was agreed to. There is a territory, there's a place that is part of, that will exist, that God's going to build. That's what Abraham was attending to. That's what his goal was. Romans chapter 4 explains that in great detail. I suggest you read that when you get the opportunity. It explains how this process was supposed to work. It was his faith or trust that granted Abraham all these blessings. It had nothing to do with the way of his life, which is why, as Greg had asked earlier, this circumcision was done afterward. That's a big deal. The agreement with Abraham was done, and promise to Abraham, before the circumcision was put in. The circumcision where the law shows up, that's done after the agreement. So Abraham's trust, his belief in God, God's agreement, I will do this, problem solved, done, is done strictly on Abraham's trust. Has nothing to do with Abraham's obedient actions in the law. Now you'll notice, the faith that works, work that faith doesn't work. What was the only action Abraham did, which wasn't a law, but what was the action he did that showed his trust?
He was going to kill his son.
Well, that's later. But at this point, what was the act that Abraham has done that showed God that Abraham trusted God?
Circumcision
is after this. This point in time is before circumcision. Chapter 15 is before circumcision.
Just leaving home?
Just leaving home. Just leaving his family. I'm going to go. Is there anything there for me? No. Is there family there? No. Is there land for me? No, someone else owns it. But I'm going to go anyway. That act of trust was God said, here's a man that's worth, is obedient. Not in obedience of the law, as far as kill this animal for that, sacrifice, do this for that, or any of those rules, you know, this is how you clean houses, none of that stuff. It's just go. Just go. It's okay to go. Yes, sure.
He's a man that deeply loves Allah.
Exactly. It's deep within inside him. That is a great explanation. Deeply inside of him. So that is where he gets his righteousness from, and which is important why God wanted all the laws, all the circumcision were done after Abraham's agreement. And that's what makes his name great. Each one of us are here because of what reason? Because Abraham loved God, not because of Abraham's obedience to the Torah. We're here because Abraham loved God. That greatness in God, that great make his name great, every single person who believes in God through their faith or trust in him is a descendant of Abraham. All because of that action. We are not descendants of Moses and Aaron. We're not. Those are not our sources. Those are not our purposes in life. They're not Moses and Aaron. That's not why we trust or believe or have righteousness. It's not based on that. That their rules and their instructions are based on how we live our lives. How we do things. It's not living in an instruction book. Do this, don't do that. Our belief and trust in God is the same way Abraham's belief and trust in God. That's why we're here today. That's our faith. That's what we're based on. That's what defines us, who we are and what we are. As a result, we become descendants of Abraham in the same fashion. Galatians chapter 3, which was mentioned by somebody earlier, explains that very well. The whole chapter explains it. That every person is blessed as a result because that faith, that trust in Abraham. The whole chapter, we discussed the whole thing. We won't go through all of it today. I'm out of time. The last one, which is bless those who bless you, curse those who curse you, it's one of the last blessings that God gave to him. That is, explains Galatians chapter 4, explains what that concept even means. So Galatians 4 explains it very well. Hagar was a bondwoman. Ishmael, of course, descendant of flesh. It is the act of your flesh. When you are born as an infant, what comes out? Is it your obedience to God or is it your flesh? Your flesh. Does the infant obey God?
No.
No. Does the infant comprehend God?
No.
It has a flesh and body. Does Ishmael, when he was produced forward, he is the flesh. It's important why the angel told Hagar, go back and submit to Sarai. Do not flee. Because the flesh must be subdued by the spirit within inside you. that trust in God has to be subdued. That's the point. You don't get to cut your flesh off and say, okay, I'm done. Don't commit suicide. It doesn't work that way. You didn't submit anything. You succumbed to it instead. So Ishmael, the bondwoman, Hagar, all of them were, in lack of a better term, required components to explain the symbolism of suppressing your flesh, suppressing your earthly desires, suppressing what is sinful over what the promise was, or under what the promise was. What's the promise? Through Isaac. The promise of God. Promise of life. I will be their God. They will be my people. I am at one with them. You have to do that. We all have to do that. Our desires, whatever they are, makes no difference what they are. It could be, who cares? Imagine your fleshly desire, imagine it, whatever it is, that has to be suppressed. That's where Ishmael and Hagar come in. That symbolism, that act of it had to be suppressed, which is why she had to be submissive, to Sarai, and Abraham instructed Sarai, she's your bondwoman, she's your bondservant, do with her as you see please. The angel went back to say, no, go back, submit, subdue yourself as you were to be subdued, as you were submitted. And then eventually Sarai, finding when Ishmael gets whatever happened to him and Isaac, they finally get kicked out. They're done. As far as your flesh has now finally been discarded from you. That's the symbols behind it. Your flesh has been now, is no longer necessary. You now received, Isaac, your promise. You received the great gift. So the flesh is now cut away or cast off. That's all symbolic and important part of it. So all this stuff that was going on from the firstborn is your physical body. It's what you're supposed to dispose of. But no different than Cain. Same way, being the firstborn. He was the firstborn, but he had to be suppressed in order to get your faith strong, in order to get the promise that God gave. So the blessed is bless you, curse those who curse you, comes to you curse your flesh, you bless the promise that God gave. That's the whole point behind it. Pharaoh's example of that, Abimelech later on is example of that as well. The last part we come to talk to you today, because I'm out of time to cover everything else, is all the families of the earth shall be blessed, the last agreement that God gave to him. Obviously, which we discussed briefly, all the nations promised and granted were very, very, very well blessed. Everybody who believes and trusts in faith in God is all thanks to Abraham. Every one of us. Even our parents and grandparents and generations ago, we were all blessed, every family, because Abraham. That's the reason. Because he followed and went. So everybody, every nation of the earth, every family is blessed because of him. Chapter 17 discusses that rather well. And I'm not cover all of it because I'm out of time. But you can check it again if you like. That's one of the reasons why God explains and says, all right, at this point in time, Abram, I am changing your name. Because now you are inclusive of all nations. All nations, all families are blessed through you. Abraham goes from Abram to Abraham, which is inclusive of the nations into as well. Even those who are part, all peoples who are part of Abraham, which is where the circumcision comes in, it did not include only Abraham's descendants. Who else did God include in the circumcision agreement?
Everybody.
Every male, purchased, unpurchased, born in your household, makes the difference. Everybody. All of them are part of this agreement. Your faith. You trust. And the circumcision is nothing more than a mark that identifies, I am part of Abraham's family. I'm part of that agreement. I'm part of that promise. The same promise God gave to Abraham, I want that too. That's all it means. Now, circumcision in Colossians explains a little bit more as far as, which Moses said the same thing, but people didn't pay attention to Moses. That circumcision of your heart, your inside, is what actually the point is.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hillel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hillel.info. That's hallel.info. Hillel.info.